Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the end game should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
Welcome, everybody, to another long-awaited episode of The Endgame. Joining me, as always, the man himself, Bill Fleckenstein. Mate, how are you?
I'm fine. How about yourself? How are you doing these days?
I'm doing very, very well. I'm ensconced in the UK for my sins. Who goes to the UK in the summer? I mean, I must be an idiot. But here I am.
We got another wedding or something you're prepared for?
No. I came to see my grandkids and I'm bouncing around.
Well, that's a good reason.
Yeah, it's a really good. See my dad, see my grandkids, see all the generations of the Williams family, all the generations that still remain. How about you? What are you up to?
Not much. Summer in Seattle, other than the disastrous politics of the place, it's a beautiful place to be.
Seattle in the summer?
Yeah. Seattle in the summer is the best place to be. It's sunny. Not in the winter.
Yeah, that's true. Now, when is the summer in Seattle? It's like the third week of June, isn't it? As far as I remember.
I often call it January, but this year was beautiful. It didn't rain
January,
once.
There you go.
Summer
there you
go. Is usually like mid-July to October-ish.
Well, I mean, the one thing that Seattle doesn't seem to have in its weather is volatility, which is unfortunate. It seems to be pretty predictable. But the subject at hand for you and I today, he said with a segue that clunked like a really poor gear change, is volatility. And we have someone joining us to discuss it who knows an awful lot more about it than us, and that's Chris Sidial of Ambrose Group. Now, Chris reached out to you on Twitter, right, to talk about this because it's something that we've been looking to chat about for a while.
Yeah, he and I have had a couple of discussions over the years, and he seems to feel that it's a moment in time when folks need to be aware of the dynamics. And I'm always interested in talking to people who are smart operators in that arena. And so I'm really, really curious to see what he's seeing that he wants us to know about.
Well, why don't we allay your curiosity and invite Chris to join us? What do you reckon?
I think that's a good idea.
Chris, welcome to the Endgame, my friend. It's so good to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Well, the world of volatility is something that Fleck and I, no matter how hard we try, we can't get away from. So it's great to have you to come and talk a little bit of vol to us because we've kind of ducked it for a while now, the two of us. Not as long as we've ducked crypto, but we've ducked vol for a while as well now. So why don't we just get a little bit of background about you and your firm and what it is you guys do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started out as a prop trader. Right? I was a prop trader on two different desks, Chimera Securities and Xanthus Capital. And then I went to a large Canadian investment bank. I spent 3.5 years there, and most of my time was on the exotic derivatives desk, right? So as an exotic derivatives trader, you're always thinking about tail risk hedging or, you know, what can go wrong. In March of 2020 came, and I had decided to branch out with a couple of my partners who are ex-CTC, ex-Citadel dudes. And we had this idea that, you know, when you traditionally think of tail risk hedging in the institutional space, you think of, all right, I'm just going to sit there and bleed and bleed and bleed, you know, for years until I get an event. And we said, you know, due to our background in prop trading, we said, hey, you could run a book that is effectively flat during normal market environments by using a lot of short-term prop strategies, while at the same time being long tails, right? So effectively, if you are an investor, you know, you can invest in this vehicle that is flat during normal environments and then has this humongous return, you know, like 200, 400% during a crash. So for an investor, it's a much more like digestible hedge. And we set on out to do that. And it's crazy to think we're in year three now and, you know, we've accomplished that. So we're quite happy. Our investors are quite happy. And I think a lot of people are gravitating over to this new view of tail risk hedging. But it becomes even more interesting because the vol space is changing at such a dynamic rate. It's like every day, the options market, especially in the US equity market, is adapting to new participants. It's causing the market to react certain ways. So, you know, maybe I'm biased, but I think it's a really cool time to be like a vol trader.
Well, just out of curiosity, can you give kind of a concrete example of how it's changing? For instance, it used to be like this and now it's like that. So listeners can get some sense of what you're looking at or what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely right. So when we started the firm as you know a tail risk fund, what we said was it was really predicated on a thesis that because of the market microstructure changing, our view was that you would see more tail events. So let's say historically over a full market cycle, you saw one tail event. It was our belief that you would see two or three. And I think when you look at historically what has transpired in the vol space over the last 5 to 6 years, I think that's very evident. I mean, you know, you have events like COVID, Volmageddon, right? There are a couple of other little blips in there, but pretty much what we're saying is that the vol market will be more reactive to these sort of sell-offs. I think the biggest thing that really opened everybody's eyes is to see how reflexive the market could be based on how the option market works, right? So everybody remembers the whole GameStop and AMC thing. And I always talk about this because it's the best way that, you know, I could kind of explain how severe or how impactful this could be, right? So you have a market participant will come in and let's say they buy a call. The dealer will be short a call. And then in order to hedge his risk, he'll be buying stock. So that can reflexively drive the asset price higher. And at the same accord, people forget that it works on the other way, right? So that can reflexively drive the asset price lower. So because the option market has 4X'd since 2020, you have to think that, okay, well, the underlying move in the broad market has to be impacted by the fact that more and more people are trading options, more institutions are trading options, and the impact of it will stem from that.
4X is an enormous change, though. Are there buckets that are responsible for that? I can understand how when we had the idiotic lockdowns, a lot of people at home were trading. I could see how a lot of retail would have exploded, but that's kind of behind us. So what's behind this? I mean, a 4X change in a market that wasn't tiny to begin with seems enormous to me. How did those buckets grow, if you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two reasons. One, because the exchanges started realizing there was an appetite for it, right? So they started listing shorter dated expirations, and now you have zero DT options, right? So you have options for every single day of the week. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that after March of 2020, you had a lot of institutional mandates that got put in, right? So after COVID, a lot more larger 40 Act funds and larger institutions started saying, okay, we want to implement options into our portfolio, right? And in today, right, you have ETFs that have options embedded in them as well. So when you had that sort of institutional push and the exchanges that sort of accepted it during 2021, you had that huge boom of just, it wasn't only retail, it was huge institutions that had that mandate accepted.
From the professional investor side of this equation, if you're not in the vol space, you kind of watch what's going on, scratch your head. You mentioned the zeros there. This explosion we've seen in pure casino behavior. And I always kind of picture the professionals just sitting there rubbing their hands every day when this stuff goes on. And sure, there's going to be a day when you're going to get carried out. But am I right thinking this has just been an absolute godsend for pure hardcore vol and options traders?
Yes. yes. I think what this does for more sophisticated vol shops, it allows them to hedge, you know, some of their gamma risk, some of their vega risk, you know, much more effectively than you were able to do in the past. However, what this also does on the flip side is it opens the door for more systematic users of these options to implement these sort of yield generating programs, which, you know, we've seen how this has worked in the past. It has led to, you know, bigger blowups, right? You think about the vol ETPs in 2017 and how it led to the, you know, Volmageddon in 2018. It's almost like a similar feel, right? Because structurally, you can't just have people systematically selling these options and think that there is not going to be any sort of effect that comes from them. And that's really what you're seeing right now, is that a lot of people are coming in and using the options to systematically generate some sort of a yield.
Well, so if they're going to be trying to create yield, then they're basically sellers of premium, which means they're asking for trouble.
That's the thing, right? A lot of people overlook the viewpoint as to how detrimental short convexity could be, right? And, you know, kind of talking to the extremity of like short vol, you know, you think of like variance swaps And for, you know, a decade and a half, you had people that were pitching variant swaps. Oh, sell variant swaps. Variant swaps have a 2.5 sharp, right? And this is the CAGR that it returns. And, you know, for about pretty much like a decade and a half, you had that all those gains wiped out in 3 weeks during March of 2020, right? Completely wiped out. And now you look at the variant swap market and it is, you know, it's nothing like what it was before because everybody, you know, was very, very scared to partake in that. But the, you know, the more interesting thing from that is that it's not that vol selling has went away. And, you know, Fleck, I reached out to you to tell you about this because I thought it was the most interesting thing. But to us, we have never seen short volatility make its way back into a system at such a rapid rate like this, right? So when you think of behaviorally—
Sorry, Chris, I don't mean to interrupt, but can you give us some perspective when you said it? This comeback at such a rate, can you give us a mosaic as to, you know, what the foothills and mountains are like for perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So one, I'm going to give you guys a data point that, to give you some sort of understanding to know how much higher it is. And then I'm going to kind of walk you through like how we got here. So if you don't have to take our research from it, but like Morgan Stanley puts out a chart on net notional vega, and I think it's on my Twitter as well. But if you look at the net notional vega today, it is higher than where it was during January of 2020. And that's interesting because when you think of January 2020, you think of a time where everybody was short volatility. You had VIX into the single digits multiple times. You had, you know, everybody was short volatility. So to think that today that number is higher, that's really surprising. And a byproduct of that is because there are more people trading options today than ever before. So naturally, you're just going to have that balloon number. But the reason why we got here is because the fall market has this very interesting behavioral dynamic to it that waxes and wanes. And it's very, it can be telegraphed if you participate in it, right? So when you think of 2017 was a year where realized volatility was really, really low, right? Everybody was selling volatility. It was almost a sin if you weren't. And then what happened, right? Volmageddon happens and all the short volatility participants kind of get blown out, okay? So now everybody switches and they're like, oh, long volatility is great, right? Fast forward now to December of 2018, when the Fed starts talking about raising interest rates, the market dropped 20% in a month, and what traditionally would be followed by a big vol spike, vol had underperformed. Equity vol underperformed that, really did not do well.
Because too many people were long already? Was that the consequence?
Right, that's the behavioral sort of wax and wane, right? Because all the people that got cycled out of the short vol during Volmageddon thought, oh yeah, long vol, and then long vol underperforms, right? So now, same thing. When long vol underperforms, we fast forward a year and a half, or you know, a year and some change, to COVID. And then what happens is short vol gets blown out, right? So all the people that were like, oh, short vol is great, they get blown out. Now, after that point, everybody's saying, oh, long vol is the best. And then we fast forward to 2022, where the market drops 20-something percent and equity long volatility underperforms, right? So it's like this hopscotch type of back and forth. And where we are behaviorally, we're at the point where you're seeing more people say, oh, long volatility sucks. You know, this is a great time to be short volatility. The short volatility programs are working. You know, these things are putting up numbers. And for the last year and a half, you know, they've done phenomenal. So behaviorally, we're at that point in the cycle where everybody hates long volatility. And, you know, short volatility is really what's in vogue.
For the folks at home, would you tell them what you mean when you say vega? Because I know a lot of people are not necessarily going to know what that means. Just I know what it is, but I want you to use it in your words.
Yeah, it's just the dollar terms of volatility, right? So when you have a vol trader on the street, there's like a dollar notional that gets tagged to every option, right? So if you move, like let's say the vega on an option is $100 and you move that option goes one vol point higher, you make $100 if you are long the option. So that's all it is. Guys use vol and vega.
It's a dollar exposure kind of a number, right?
Correct.
For people who are scratching their heads. All right, thank you.
So Chris, I've always had this perception in my head that you know, it's so interesting to hear you talk about the behavioral aspects of vol, because to my mind, and I'm please tell me if I'm wrong, I've always had this feeling that vol wasn't behavioral. It never was behavioral. You know, vol was there, and when markets blew up, vol would spike. When markets calmed down, vol would come down. And you could see vol behaving in line with the ebbs and flows of the market. And you go back to 08, and since then, probably since kind of 13 onwards, it feels to me as though vol has not become so representative of the ebbs and flows in markets like it used to be. I used to think of it as like this neutral barometer. I could look at vol and know what the markets were doing. Now it feels to me like I can't do that. It feels like vol, as you said, vol underperformed on the way up. We've seen every single vol episode get crushed back to earth really, really quickly when everything that you read and everything you see in the underlying market suggests that we are in a period of heightened volatility. How has the nature of volatility changed over this last 10 years?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. And, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, Grant, I would kind of think that vol is behavioral. And I'll explain to you why, because I think that it's really the heartbeat of where the fear is in the market, right? Because from a spot move perspective, you could have the broad market drop, you know, 1% today, and maybe VIX moves up, you know, 10 vol points. But tomorrow you could have the same thing. S&P drops 1% and the VIX moves up, you know, 2 vol points or something like that. The catalyst or the news behind it is the driving factor that's going to insinuate that fear, right? So a lot of times people talk about positioning, which is super crucial, right? And the reason why it backs into that is because if you're offsides on positioning, you're going to be more fearful, which means you aggressively need to hedge, which means vol will be more reactive, right? So when I think of vol, I think of vol as really the heartbeat of the market that's getting a sense of that behavior. What is really the sentiment of how the market feels? Now, when you think of 2022, you know, undeniably, you know, vol had underperformed. And I think the important thing to point out is that it had underperformed because it was so well telegraphed. If you spoke to people during 2021, there were people that were talking about, listen, inflation is here and the Fed is going to have a hard time trying to put this thing back in the box and you should prepare for it. Because of that, you kind of have this sort of pre-hedging that takes place, right? Or that when people are telegraphed to the news, vol is not really going to be as reactive as opposed to COVID. You know, when you think of COVID, I mean, even like the late weeks of February of 2022, there was a lot of back and forth. You know, a lot of people would say, oh, you know, maybe this isn't going to be a big deal, or maybe it is going to be a big deal, right? And then it's really shocked everybody when institutions started shutting down. So that's really that shell shock that gets vol going. And I think that it's important for people to understand that, because if things are telegraphed, then there's going to be no volatility. You know, it's almost like if somebody tells you, hey, I'm going to hit you with a bat in 5 minutes, you're preparing to be hit with a bat in 5 minutes, you know, as opposed to some guy just comes up to you on the street and just hits you with a bat. You know, your mind is just going to be all over the place. So that's kind of how I think about it from a behavioral standpoint.
And to simplify it, before, vol, you know, was kind of a consequence of market behavior, but it seems like once it became a quote-unquote product to either own it or sell it, then the natural market behavior probably has created some of these, we like short vol, we like long, that's more of a what happens of people, you know, buying high and selling low in markets generically, right?
Right, right. And people got attached to that volatility risk premium as well, right? Because people looked at this and they said, oh, wow, you know, we could collect a premium for doing this and charge management fees and do this over and over and over, right? And Wall Street ate it up. And even today, right, you have tons of volatility products, volatility ETPs, you know, systematic sort of vol selling. It's a hot sell on Wall Street because, I mean, think of insurance, right? That's really what it is. It's effectively like sophisticated insurance. So, you know, when you have something that could generate that sort of yield and that sort of appetite, people are going to push this, you know, down people's throats. And that's why it becomes more and more popularized.
Because you use that word sophisticated there. And I think that's such a key point to make here, because the vol markets are incredibly sophisticated. And yet, to your point, you know, they've been kind of shoehorned into retail products. And I've lost count of how many times I've heard people speaking at investor conferences where there's a lot of high net worth or is retail in the crowd. People say, oh, you just want to be long vol, as if it's a thing that it's really easy to do in a way that isn't just going to eat you alive slowly and slowly over time. When people are thinking about this, when people are thinking out there, listen to this, I want to be long vol, can you talk a little bit about the pitfalls of being long vol as a buying these ETPs, buying the things that supposedly give you exposure to vol? Because as I understand it, they're really not what people need to be owning.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, we set out to start the business because, like I said, when we looked at the tail risk space, we said, okay, there are different prop firms that embody this sort of model where you use a lot of the shorter term prop strats to use active trading to offset the carry. And effectively, when things hit the fan, right, you're flat during normal environments. But when things hit the fan, you make this huge return, right? And we looked at that model and we said, okay, use that same sort of model that we know, you know, exists in the prop world and bring it to the hedge fund space, because a lot of these tail risk funds just continue to bleed and bleed and bleed and bleed. And it's hard for investors to sort of digest that, right? So, you know, I would really advocate for people to not be on either or side, right? And what I mean by that is there's nothing wrong with selling volatility, right? And there's nothing wrong with buying volatility, but it's when it's done incorrectly or systematically or dogmatically, that's when these sort of things can be a problem, right? And when you think of all these sort of products that are out there that do try to replicate, you know, long volatility, it can be really problematic for the investor because they think that, or they don't really understand how bad this drag can be. You know, if you look at some of the, you know, tail risk funds and tail risk products performance, some have bled out 60, 70% over the last 2 years, right? So if you give a person $1 million, right, and they bleed on out, you know, and that over the next 3 years, let's say they lose 75% of it, and now your capital is 250,000. Yeah, great. You could make 4X during the next 10
years. Now you're even, yeah.
Exactly. And you're back to even, right? So those sort of things are suboptimal. I think where investors really need to understand is that this is one of those things that they might, you know, want to outsource. Like if I were investing in, you know, some sort of a bond allocation towards, you know, somebody who's trading credit spreads or something like that, I would outsource it completely because I understand that market has pitfalls and things that I may not be able to do. So when smaller investors kind of come to me and say like, hey, look, I want to be long vol or something like that, you know, I generally will point them into the angle to say, hey, you may rather focus on, you know, a more holistic portfolio than trying to tactically develop a portfolio, you know, but the investors that are more so, you know, guarding, like, let's say $10 million of wealth, $5 million of wealth, you can probably participate in a long volatility sort of thing. So I just think that there's some things that are just not meant for everybody in the investing space, you know?
So a generic question that comes to mind, just out of fascination, it's intuitively obvious why a long vol fund bleeds out, right? It's a melting ice cube, you own premium. And what I'm curious about is, without giving away all your secrets, how does one go about being long the melting ice cube, but to counteract the melting? Is it more about changing the length of the duration of your portfolio or finding some, you're going to have to sell something to counteract the melt. And I'm trying to figure out generically, or it might be case specific, hopefully you know what I'm asking you and you can.
Yeah, no, I do. I do, like, for sure. Right. So I'm not going to mention any names because I don't want to get in trouble. But there's a famous quote unquote tail risk fund that marketed themselves as a tail risk fund back in the day. Right. And then a semi tail event happened and they lost a ton of money. And investors came to them and said, well, how in the world did you lose money? Volatility went up. That's because they were effectively doing things like that. Right. Where they were selling volatility to fund volatility and measuring that sort of relationship. You know, you take on basis risk, timing risk, belly risk. There's all sorts of inherent risks that exist in it, right? So there are firms who are relative value vol shops that do that. And these relative value vol shops are not tail risk funds, right? Or not long vol. They trade vol, you know, agnostically. But when you are a tail risk fund, that's the number one thing, right? You have to make sure you are not compromising the mandate of what you're trying to do. So our belief is that, okay, we don't need to sell volatility to be long volatility. We can use more so what we call medium frequency short-term strategy. So if we can be in and out of these positions intraday, right? So if you think of the book in two different lens, one side, you're long a ton of 1 to 6 month vol, right? Where you have all these tails. But on the other side, imagine if you can be in and out of these sort of trades intraday, these shorter term prop strats intraday in a matter of 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 20 minutes. The returns that you make on that side will inherently pretty much offset the losses that will come from the long volatility on the other side, right? And in order to do this, you need a form of alpha, right? So this is where a lot of people go wrong in the vol space, because they will try to make that match without having a form of alpha. And they'll do things and say, we'll sell credit vol to buy S&P vol, right? And you'll do that. And for 1 year, that may work. And then, you know, it doesn't work, right? So at the end of the day, you know, we've talked about this in a lot of detail. You know, as much as we are advocates for tail risk hedging, our belief is you need a form of alpha to be able to do this effectively. If you don't have the alpha, it will be suboptimal for you in the long run.
Chris, how much more difficult has that become? Because my great mate Steve Diggle, when he had his vol fund back in the 2000s, you know, they were paying for the option decay with ARB strategies in Asia, you know, and there were all kinds of fantastic ARB strategies there between, you know, shares and preferred shares, and there were all kinds of convert ARBs. There were all kinds of things that weren't strictly vol that the idiosyncrasies of a lot of these Asian markets in places like Korea, for example, afforded you ways to do that, to long and short different share classes. There were all kinds of ways that you could extract away from the vol world that were reliable enough to help you pay for the bleed. When you're concentrating everything in vol world, and you're trying to pay for the vol with the vol, how much more difficult has that become? Because that seems like such a tough thing to try and do to me.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that with the growth of technology and how high-frequency trading firms work and market makers that deploy high-frequency trading activities, it's become much, much more difficult to source edge in the U.S. equity market, especially the U.S. equity derivative market, right? So this is kind of where we rely on our background as prop traders. You know, I thank God that we were prop traders, because this is where you get to learn that sort of stuff, right? And like develop those sort of edges and things and think about markets and from a supply and demand perspective and take that out. You know, one thing that I would say is that for what we do, we know we are capacity constrained. That's the catch, right? Is that like, you'll never grow to be a $2 billion huge fund, right? For you will be able to grow to a certain point. But at some point, if you do have a form of alpha, that kind of cuts off. So for
yeah,
us—
growth has been the death of so many great strategies. You know, that's a great, I'm glad that's something you focus on because, sorry to interrupt, but I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. No, it's the elephant in the room and it's the obvious thing. It's that, you know, if you have something that's good, and you know that there's a form of alpha in it in this type of market, you know you're going to cut on out. So we look at that, and you know, I think our investors look at it as a good thing. We look at it as a good thing. But on the flip side, you know, you see products that grow to be $20 billion, and you're like, who in the world is investing in this? This is terrible, you know? But that's just part of the game, I guess.
When I ran my short fund, one of the things that I wanted to do was, just because it was so easy to get run over when you're running a short-only fund, I felt like I wanted to be able to get out of everything within a couple of hours so I could only be a certain size. And then I would see guys that were trying to run short money, like with these huge books. And I'd say, how in the hell can you possibly manage that risk? Anyway, I don't want to get off on that tangent, but it's one of the things that I think is really important in specific strategies.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris, I was just going to ask about the nature of vol spikes, of tail events now, because I guess, again, I don't know why I keep going back to 2012, 2013 as when, to me, as a kind of casual observer of this, I saw it change, but feel free to disavow me of that notion. But it seemed like every single tail event, quasi-tail event, vol spike that you see gets crushed so quickly now. You know, this natural downward pressure on vol is such that trying to make money in vol, if you're there for these tail events or there for the spikes, your timing has to be so precise, right? Because as you've alluded to, it's really tough to wait for these things. You have to try and find a way to get paid to wait. And then when they happen, if you don't have them on, by the time you get them on, you know, the damn thing's over. It's extraordinary to watch from the kind of sidelines for me. So can you talk a little bit about whether the nature of these spikes has changed? And if so, what you kind of put that down to?
Yeah, absolutely. So This is one of the points of our thesis as well. We think that so many things have popped up within the distribution, right? We've seen all these sort of things, but the one thing that we haven't seen is a humongous vol move to the upside where vol remains sticky. And we think that that could be our next sort of base case for the next real vol event. When you think of how investors, especially like systematic vol investors, even on the long side, look to participate in these things, it's everybody has the same mentality that you just said, Grant. Everybody knows that, yeah, vol is mean reverting and VIX can only be at 60 for 2 days, right? And then it'll come down, right? There's no way that this could stay higher. And we kind of think that that's sort of next in the cards to play out, whether it's, you know, a year from now, 5 years from now, you're bound to see that pop up on the roulette wheel eventually. So when we think about this, you know, that's kind of how we look at the environment. We know that everybody else is thinking about vol from that perspective, that vol will be mean reverting. And naturally, you know, it has mean reverting components to it because the way how VIX is priced is based off of SPX options. And, you know, I don't want to nerd on out too much into that. But I think that even when you look at market participants like, you know, huge asset firms that have these sort of hedging programs, you know, there's a big asset firm that's notorious for its hedging. And when you look at where they sold their VIX calls during COVID, they sold them at like 35, you know, and they missed the move as VIX went to, you know, 80 something. So when we assess the environment, we think that one of the next sort of things to pop up could be this sort of high vol slash stickiness because market participants are all moving in that sort of mentality that when VIX is at 60 or when VIX is at 30, 40, sell it.
What does that event look like, Chris? Because that, to me, at first blush, sounds like something that could be incredibly painful for a lot of people. If VIX goes up, yeah, you know, there are people who are short volatility get crushed. Then you get a whole bunch of people piling on selling volatility. If it stays up there,
then they get run over.
That sounds like a world of trouble to me. So what does that look like if that happens?
So we personally think that the way how the next sort of real big tail event will price vol, you could see VIX over 100. And the reason for that is because mechanically, again, the VIX calc is derived off of SPX options. It's a strip of SPX options. So naturally, when you have more people engaged in trading SPX options, which, by the way, you know, we talk about the option activity, SPX option volume has, you know, tripled, quadrupled over the last 4 years. It's tremendous. So more people are now playing in this sort of game, and more people are playing in this game to sell volatility, right? So when we think about what can mechanically transpire during the next vol event where people are pulling liquidity and people are aggressively looking to hedge with these sort of options, that can be the sort of thing that catapults the actual calculation to have VIX, you know, mechanically go over 100. So it's really, and you know, you hear a lot of people too with the counter argument and say things like, oh, look, VIX is broken because you know, zero DTEs are here and everybody's hedging with zero DTEs. An easy thing to do is just check the VIX contracts, right? The VIX volume contracts show that thesis is incorrect. More people continually trade VIX options and SPX options, right? So people are still engaging in VIX. And the other thing too is that large institutions during a real sort of, you know, tail event or a catalyst of a tail event, nobody's going to hedge using zero DTE options. If you're running, you know, a $20 billion book or, you know, a $5 billion book or something like that, and you know that, you know, God forbid there is a nuclear war going on, you're not going to say, oh, let me buy the zero DTE hedge tomorrow. You're going to say, I need to extend my duration to 30, 40, 50, 60 days because this war could go on for, you know, God knows how long. So I think that that kind of gives us, you know, from a contrarian standpoint, that gives us more affirmation too in our thesis that during the next event, everybody kind of thinks VIX is dead, and that's going to kind of be the thing that comes to life and, you know, kind of reminds people how reactive it can be.
Let me ask you about the VIX term structure, because I've seen some interesting tweets in the last couple of days from my buddy Jim Carroll, who you may or may not be aware of, I'm sure.
Yep,
you guys in the vol world, yeah, I'm sure you guys all know each other. It's like a little club. Jim and I know each other, and he's a super smart guy. And I've just looked at some of his tweets talking about how we've had some head fakes in term structure in the last couple of days. Can you talk a little bit about that, kind of elaborate on it for people and talk a little bit about what Jim was trying to allude to there?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, Jim's a friend of mine, good guy. I think he puts out some good commentary too.
Yeah.
We should
give him a shout out for his Twitter handle at Vixologist.
Yes. Yep. So if you look at my Twitter, you would see it, the threads that I've been writing are somewhat in line as to what he has been saying as well, right? So if you've been trading vol over the last 2 weeks, you've realized, and I'm going to call this spot vol beta, and I'll explain to you exactly what it means, right? So for every 1% move in the S&P, how does this translate into vol points, right? So you may see the S&P go down 1% today, and maybe the VIX goes up 5 points. Versus tomorrow, the S&P may go down 1%. You may see VIX go up 1 vol point, right? So very, very different when you compare those sort of two things. Over the last 2 weeks, it's been interesting because you've been seeing vol start becoming more reactive, right? So when the whole yen news started coming out, vol started to be very reactive. When you heard the downgrade news coming out, vol started to be way more reactive. Even Apple missing on earnings, vol started to be more reactive. So what he's talking about is when we came in today, the market was down, I think like 17 or 30 basis points or something like that. And vol was down, which was surprising because over the last few weeks, when you're seeing the market down, vol's been moving. Vol's been really starting to pick up in the front of the VIX term structure. So that's really what he was referencing there. And I think that this plays back into what we were talking about before as to how complex vol could really be for some market participants, right? Because it could be frustrating for people to look at this and say, geez, the S&P is down today. Why are my puts not making money? Why are my puts losing money? The S&P is down today. Because it goes, three and four steps further than that if you're trading these sort of instruments.
Given the fact that there is a psychological component to this where we seem to go in waves. Okay, we all got to own vol. Oh, that didn't work. We got to sell vol. And like we've done this rinse and repeat a group of times in the last 5 or 7 years, as you've noted. But now we're at a position where the market of those products is bigger than ever. It seems your conclusion that one of these times we're going to have a vol event that's going to cause the VIX to hang out higher for longer, to steal the current term about the economy. And that's going to cause some real trouble. How many of the people in your world have that view? How isolated is that opinion at this juncture, would you guess?
Yeah, the vol space is it can be an echo chamber to an extent, right? You have people in this space that definitely, kind of bounce ideas off of each other. So I'd like to think that there's a decent chunk of people who do believe that equity vol is the next thing to really get carried out. I mean, when you look at the last 2 years, you've had big vol moves in everything besides equity vol. Commodity vol, rates vol, FX vol, all have been really moving and paying well. And equities continue to, really, really stay resilient, and equity vol continues to remain pinned down. And I think because structurally what is happening, because you have all these sort of systematic vol control funds and vol targeting and overlay programs and all these sort of things that are baked in now prior to 2020. I mean, I could tell you from firsthand experience, I saw what it was like for large institutions to deleverage a book during March of 2020. These people were selling humongous amounts. So people, when I talk to the average day investor, they think that, Apple went down 40% because, COVID was here. It wasn't because COVID was here. It's because this guy who owned, X amount of Apple, he was forced to deleverage out of this position, right? And when you have this sort of, this structural component of the market that is changing like that, that sort of reflexivity that grows is so much more magnified today than when it was during March of 2020. So if you put the same move, the same spot move, the same catalyst from March of 2020 into the market today, the move will be more extreme. The vol move will be more extreme. And that's really the viewpoint that we have. And I think that it's evident when you look at what has been baked into the market and all these products and all these things of that sort. So maybe we're biased because, you know, we see it more than other people, but it wasn't a thesis that we just pulled out of a hat. You know, other guys.
So, to say it in plain, simple English, the powder keg is far bigger now than it's ever been before.
Yeah, absolutely.
If we get to the point where the spark hits and boom.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
Chris, can we go back to something we touched on a little bit earlier, and that's these zero DT options? Because it's been such a fascinating thing to watch this mindset take hold and to watch the volume in those things just explode. I mean, I really did not see that coming. Even after the meme stock stuff and the GameStop and AMC and all that stuff, I was absolutely staggered watching the zero expiry stuff go on, particularly in something like Tesla, for example, which was just extraordinary to watch that happen. Can you give us, I guess, a kind of a play-by-play from your perch as to how that thing unfolded and what the Vol community were making of that as it happened? Because like I said, I just found the whole thing absolutely astonishing to watch.
Yeah, we actually wrote a paper. It's on our website that talked about zero DT options, because there was a lot of bad information that was going on about the zero DT options. Ironically enough, retail was getting blamed. People thought that, yeah, retail participants are the main participants in that. And when we backed into the data, and you know, we spent a lot of time back into the data and you know, talking to different market makers, talking to different desks. Ironically enough, it wasn't retail. It was a bulk of the RIA community and a lot of large institutions. So, you know, when you have these sort of large institutions that are implementing these sort of yield programs, you get things like that. And you'd be surprised. There are even large insurance companies that are participating in that, right? And some people are like, there's no way insurance companies are participating. But, you know.
Sure they are.
Trust me, they are.
Sure they are.
The gentleman, you know, we've spoken to people from there that tell us, you know, the mandate as to what, why and what they're participating in from that stance. But I think the big boom has really been from the RIA community. And a byproduct of that has been because of the increase in rates and the slight deleveraging that you saw in equities. And what I mean by that is during 2022, you know, if you were an RIA, you had your clients in cash, right? For the most part of that. A lot of RIAs kind of pulled their clients out as equities started to fall. And they said, hey, you know, there's another way that we could make 12% a year. And the clients started becoming interested. And they said, hey, look, you make 12% a year. We do this sort of wheel program where we sell these short-dated options. And more and more and more people started signing up for those sort of RIA sort of programs. So it's amazing that, yeah, you know, the retail community kind of gets blamed for that, but it's large RIAs and these larger institutions that are implementing these sort of programs on zero DT.
One question I have for you from an operational standpoint or even a strategic standpoint, the elephant in the room for the equity market's inability to discount events as it used to, in my opinion, is the passive bid, which Mike Green has done so much good work to expose. And to me, it explains a lot of things about equity market behavior. And I, for one, have tried to incorporate it into the things that I do. Do you try to factor that in to what you're doing? And if so, how? And if you don't bother, why do you not bother?
Yeah, absolutely. That's huge, right? The growth of passive investing is huge. The growth of these ETFs and the rebalance process that comes from the ETFs and that how that could have reflexive implications on the broad market, that sort of stuff is huge. I kind of bake it all into the same bucket of like reflexivity, right? So when we think about like dealer gamma hedging and we think about, you know, some of these option overlay programs and vol targeting, we kind of just toss in passive investing in that sort of bucket. And that's just our own way of thinking about things, right? Because we think about who needs to move what, how much, and when, right? And when we kind of go back to the prop strategies that I was talking about, when we look to trade, you know, on these shorter timeframes, a lot of it stems from that, right? Who needs to move what, when, and how, you know, like, are they going to do this? The growth of passive investing has absolutely changed the market microstructure in a huge way. And I think that kind of just adds to our thesis that, hey, more tail events will occur because of this sort of reflexivity that comes from it.
So, Chris, how do you go about trying to set up a way to handle more frequent tail events? Because, you know, everyone's kind of got into this pattern now where we get these blow-ups, they happen periodically, not that close together. And they all seem to be fairly distinctive. And as I said, in that last 10, 15 years, we've seen the troughs between the peaks be pretty smooth. And so if we do go into a situation like the one you're describing, where you start to see more and more vol events, that's going to necessarily change the way everybody has to look at this. So what does that look like as people try and shift the way they view volatility and the way they view the kind of profile of volatility going forward? What does that do to market structure as people try and adapt to that?
Yeah, I think, it certainly will change the market microstructure, right? So if you naturally have more people accepting volatility as an asset class and more people, you know, want a more well-rounded or holistic portfolio, you'll see more of a natural bid in, you know, tail options or things of that sort. The interesting counter to that is that we have now seen this time and time and time and time again, right? We're coming off of a event 3 years ago that destroyed people, right? That March of 2020 event, from a vol standpoint, took a lot of people out if you were short volatility. Today, even though the level of absolute vol may not be lower than what we were seeing during that point, the tails locally are trading at lower prices than they were back during that time. So, and we know this because we're executing, you know, we're out there executing and buying these tail options, right? For the last 2 years, it has been very difficult to get somebody else who's on the other side to be axed to sell tails, right? So a natural seller of tails. And that was because of the whole, you know, COVID thing. A lot of people said, tail options, you're crazy, right? You know, brokers will call you and I'll be like, well, do you want to sell me tails? And they'll be like, no. And I'll be like, okay, well, all right, bye. You know, like that's really the length of the discussion. But this year, it's been insane to see how more natural axes are coming back. More people are inclined to sell tails, and the prices that you're able to get executed at is insane, right? It's like people are selling you, you know, 6 month tail options for 2 cents, you know? Like,
and in your mind, they should be priced to what, 4 or 8?
Yeah, or, probably.
I'm trying to get a sense of the order of magnitude of mispricing in your head. I know we all make these things up, right? But I'm just curious.
Yeah, I would say at least 3 times more. Okay. You know, so it's really insane to see that.
So that's quite mispriced, which is a good edge.
Right. So for us, at least, it's amazing to see people sort of just forget, right? In 3 years, it's like everybody has just kind of forgot that, hey, markets can crash in, you know, in the very short data time frame. And you know, even before that, historically, right? Like look at 2008. The thing about 2008 is that you went through probably 5 or 6 years before people started to really want to sell vol again, right? So like from 2008, people were fearful for a while. And you know, they were kind of struck by that. But this, you know, this happened at such a rapid rate. And that's kind of what Fleck, again, going back to why, you know, I reached out to have this discussion too, is because we've never seen a time period where short volatility made its way back into the system.
So fast.
So fast, and at such a more powerful rate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have a tactical question I need to ask you. Again, when I was running my short-only fund, obviously, if you're only short, one of the things you have to do is get out of the way. And then when it happens, you got to get to work, right? And then, you know, I used to say, the research doesn't really matter. You have to do it, but you get paid for putting them on, taking them off. Yes. And so I'm wondering in your business, as I see it, a similar potential, if things start to happen, you guys start looking at each other and say, hey, God, it's finally starting. Do you then get more active in managing the tail part of the book to maybe increase your exposure? Because, okay, now's the time, we want to beef it up. Or do you say, no, we've already figured out what we want, we're just going to sit tight and let it play, and we'll react to how that plays, if you understand my question.
Yeah, absolutely. So I tell this to investors all the time that, yes, during a crash, you have to be very active. You have to be on the phone with brokers. You have to be understanding flow, right? You have to be in the game. But the bulk of the work is done during environments like this, where things are calm, right? Because what we're trying to do is use a lot of that trading to preserve your capital, right, and buy those tails when people want to sell it to us for, you know, 2 cents, 3 cents, right? And just build up that inventory, build up that book, right? So that when things are starting to move, well, we've kept your capital flat, right? So now the book is just picking up, you're just making money.
So you just kind of go into harvest mode, maybe then, not press mode.
Yes. Yeah.
That's okay. That's what I was curious about.
Yeah. So it's days like, you know, when the market's up 1% and everybody's cheering and everything's right, where we want to be buying, you know, and falls on the ground and it looks like nobody wants to touch it. No way, you know, like, absolutely not. We're the ones that are going to be asked to be better buyers of volatility during those type of moments. And that's just our sort of an investment, you know, process as to how we look at these things.
So Chris, are we really back to that world where people don't want to touch vol? I mean, I've always struggled with this, particularly given that what we've seen, you know, in the last 3 years, we've seen a pandemic like we haven't seen since 1918. We've seen a land war in Europe erupt. We've seen the stuff happening with the Bank of Japan. We've seen belligerence between China and Taiwan, America and China, the Saudis and everybody else. It just blows my mind that we are in a world that we are now, and we're back at the point where people don't want to touch vol with a barge pole. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, it's just the exhaustion that people get, right? It's what makes markets markets. It's almost like, you know, when we see the euphoria and people are expressing FOMO and chasing, you're almost like, well, you know, it's going to come back a little bit. It always does, right? But people don't react that way, right? Like, people react to their emotions, and the exhaustion of quote unquote long volatility has really depleted people out, because so many people thought 2022 was going to be the year, right? And a lot of institutional allocators kind of got fed up with that. You know, you saw three tail risk funds, or three tail risk slash long vol funds, go out of business last year because, you know, the appetite for it was not there. And, you know, the quote unquote underperformance in 2022, you know, really, really harmed them. So I think it's just this wax and wane sort of thing. That's why, you know, as to what we do is so important, because I say that if you could preserve the capital and be there and have the ammo for one time, you're good to go, right? So the money is made during these moments. If you could preserve your investor capital and then have that sort of tailwind, you're good to go. But if you're bleeding and bleeding and bleeding and constantly losing money, it's just tough for investors to stomach. And, you know, unfortunately, the majority of the products that are out there, or the majority of the exposure that's out there for long vol, it just tends to be that.
I guess this kind of just wraps back in my earlier point, you know, about, to me, volatility is this kind of living, breathing creature that's independent of markets. It's a dynamic phenomenon that is not necessarily quantifiable. It's emotion. It's all the things that are wrapped up in markets, but it doesn't have a ticker. It doesn't have a set of results. It's pure emotion and pure passion moving around in both directions. And so to have a space like that, that is inhabited by real specialists in what is a very niche product, you know, there isn't kind of retail vol stuff available. I just can't reconcile in my head how you have something that is so reactive to emotions and a group of people who are so attuned to watching that dynamic play out and reacting to it, that you could get these periods where, to use that phrase, nobody wants to touch long vol. I've never been able to reconcile it in my head. I just don't get it.
Grant, to me, it's a variation of, why do people always want to buy high and sell low? This is what markets do to you. Yeah. It's just, it doesn't matter how sophisticated you are. But
you know what I mean? It's such a specialist part of the market.
Yeah.
There aren't any tourists in the vol space. There aren't any people who can kind of come in and do
the
dumb
customers,
things.
The customers that hire the pros,
I get that.
They're the same level of tourists that we're
I get that.
About,
and right? I guess that explains why having the prop trader. Whoever thought anyone would say, thank God for prop traders? I never heard those words when I was at an investment bank prop trading.
So I think what Fleck is saying is, you know, it's true. It's, you know, yes, the vol space is pretty esoteric and opaque. But when you think of the sophisticated vol players in the space, they're still so tiny in the ecosystem, right? So when you look at us, if I go into a room, or, you know, like, for example, we were at the Global Alts conference last year, you know, this big hedge fund conference, we were like the pipsqueaks in the room, right? Like, everybody, these guys who, you know, even guys who are single person RIAs manage more money, you know, than we do. Right. So when you think of that, it's like, sophistication doesn't necessarily go hand in hand with AUM, right? You could have a guy who is controlling, you know, $10 billion in some sort of systematic vault program that is doing this, not really sophisticated, but the sophisticated vault guys in the smaller shops are kind of seeing what's going on. Actually, what I would say is that that's kind of what we noticed over the last few weeks, was that, you know, the color that we had was that there was a, you know, a large institutional hedger that was hedging for seasonality purposes, for August purposes, and they were kind of coming in and buying vol on any little dip lower, right? And the smart vol guys were kind of looking at this and they were like, well, this shouldn't, vol shouldn't be moving this way. But because you have such a guy, like a large guy that was just coming in and hoarding in, he's kind of running everybody over. And that's really what you have in the vol space is, yeah, you do have, you know, these guys that are sophisticated, but the bulk of the flow, you know, the bulk of that big flow comes from more so unsophisticated participant players in there. I mean, even when you think of like, what's the biggest volatility firm that's out there? I would think that, you know, it's probably Parallax. And Parallax
how,
is like,
how big are they? Just out of curiosity.
Probably like 3 to 4 billion or something like that. They're a small shop. You know, hopefully I don't upset the guys at Parallax. I admire them. And, you know, I think they're good guys. You know, if they're listening, shout out to them. But it's just the reality to this is that the vault guys are the small guys that are in the room. And, you know, the guys that are participate in options can really run them over. So they're still participating in vault, but they're just not as sophisticated.
Fascinating. Well, Chris, I have to say, I'm sure I've demonstrated my relative ignorance in the vol space, for which I apologize, but it's been a hugely, hugely educational hour. So I really, really thank you for that. Before we disappear, just let everybody know where they can find out more about you and you guys and what you're doing. Because I say, it's such a fascinating space and there will come a time when everyone's going to need vol. I mean, it'll be the day after they really needed it, but hey, we can do our best to give them somewhere to go, right?
Yeah. You guys can find me at ambrosgroup.com or, you know, Twitter, KSIDIII is my handle. Or just, you know, on Google. I know we have people reach out to us from all sorts of angles. So
phenomenal. Well, my friend, it's been a real joy. Thank you so much for taking this time to chat with Fleck and I. I have a suspicion this is a subject we're going to be revisiting soon, so hopefully you'll come back and talk to us more about it once we get one of these tales.
I think your notion, I hadn't thought of it before, but as soon as you said it, it rang so true to me that we're going to have a vol event where vol is sticky at a higher place for longer. It's going to really hurt people. I think that's a great idea. I'd like to make calls on that strategy.
There you go.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you guys.
All right, Chris. Take care. Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Well, mate, I have to say the subject of vol is something I find endlessly fascinating. I have so many dumb questions about it because I've only really kind of been looking at it for the last 15 years or so. And that's no time at all to get your head around vol, as it turns out.
You know, I think the thing, so many people don't even understand what the VIX is made of. You know, how it's calculated. I get people asking me all the time, well, I'm thinking about buying VIX options. Do you realize that it's in contango in the first place? I mean, you have to be, and now, it's not just a consequence of how markets behave. It's a massive asset class. And so I think this will be quite useful for, I want to say, the average sophisticated investor, be it retail or institutional, I think doesn't necessarily comprehend, you know, the dynamics of how this is operating in the background and to be aware of what may come next. So I'm hoping this will be really fascinating.
Completely agree. I think that's... That would probably have helped an awful lot of people understand it in a bit more detail. And for those of you listening that do want to find out more about the Ambrose Group and Chris Sidiel, as he said, his Twitter handle is at KSIDIII, and the website is Ambrose Group, AMBRUS Group, all one word, .com.
And where can they find you, mate? Where can they find you?
Well, in the UK at the moment, but if they want to find me on Twitter, and instead of in person, which I highly recommend, I'm much more fun on Twitter than I am in person, I promise you. They'll find me at TTMYGH. And you, my man, I presume remain unchanged.
At FleckCap, that's correct.
At FleckCap, the one and only. All right, my man, I will talk to you again soon, I hope.
Okay, great.
All right, buddy, be good.
Yeah.
Nothing we discussed during the Endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.